Hi, it's Anoushka. Today in Opinion, we're going to hear from Bernie Kraus, an ecologist who has spent 40 years documenting the changing sound of nature. But first, we're going to examine Britain's role in the war in Yemen. You're hearing the sound of a video filmed by Ahmed, who's from Hodeidah, Yemen. It shows his family on the beach.
We used to go there every Friday.
He's wearing yellow Hawaiian print surfing trunks, and he's wading into the water. His two children are splashing in the waves next to him. The family would barbecue fresh fish, relaxing and eating.
Yeah, sometimes smoking shisha there, and the children playing on the beach.
They'd stay until late in the afternoon, enjoying the time together. That peaceful existence shattered in 2015 when war broke out. Hodeidah doesn't just have lovely beaches. It's a strategic port city. The two sides of this conflict, the Houthi rebels and the Saudi-led coalition, both want control of it. Ahmed's hometown has become the focal point of Yemen's war. He tried to stay in Hodeidah for as long as he could, but he kept getting frantic calls from relatives.
Every minute they called me, you have to leave, you have to leave, you have to leave. Many people, they said, it's very dangerous to stay, go.
So a few months ago, he and his family moved away. Since then, coalition airstrikes have destroyed his neighbourhood. And now the situation is worsening. In recent weeks, troops have gathered on the outskirts of Hodeidah, preparing for a fresh wave of attacks. Some of their weapons will have been made in the UK. From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, Britain's involvement in Yemen's war.
Hodeidah is one of Yemen's biggest cities. It's a port. It was basically the country's commercial centre before the war broke out. So it's quite cosmopolitan. It's quite developed compared to a lot of the rest of the country. It has a beautiful old city wall, you know, the sort of mud brick type, and some of the beautiful gingerbread style houses.
The Guardian's Middle East correspondent, Bethan McKernan, has been reporting from Yemen. I called her at her home in Beirut.
Since the war broke out, it's become Yemen's lifeline. It's where more than 90% of the country's imports and fuel and aid comes through. Without Hodeidah, Yemen would starve.
And Bethan, there are certain conflicts that we hear a lot about, like Syria, for example. Why is Yemen not more widely covered in the Western media?
I think the main reason is because the borders are closed, so there are no refugee flows going out and turning up on Europe's doorsteps. And it also means that it's very difficult for journalists to get in. It's also a very complex conflict. There's no obvious good guys and bad guys, which makes it hard to describe in you know, short news bulletins and on TV. There are lots of Yemenis and activists who hate it when Yemen is described as the poorest country in the Arab world. They say it's a reductive term, but it's actually really crucially important for understanding what the situation there is like. I mean, there's no real middle class in Yemen that is educated and speaks English, whereas in Syria, there was a highly educated middle class that very early on got those narratives out during the Arab Spring and was very savvy about making sure English language media heard about it. So I think partly why we just don't hear as much about it as we should.
You know, you said this was a really complex conflict. I think a lot of people here don't really understand what's going on.
So Yemen has always been quite an unstable place. But the current war began in 2015 when the Houthi rebel movement overthrew the government in the capital, Sana'a. President Hadi went to his allies in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and basically asked for their help in restoring the legitimate internationally recognised government. So they mounted a military operation to do that. To try and get them out of the capital and the other cities that they've managed to take over. But it proved to be a lot more difficult than they thought, and a lot of the front lines in Yemen are basically now a stalemate. It also created a lot of chaos that left an opportunity for extremist groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS to develop. And another complication in the war now that we're 3.5 years in, is this new separatist group which wants southern Yemen to be an independent state, basically. So what you're talking about is at least sort of three wars in one, whereas when it began, it was just the Houthis versus the government.
And are all sides harming civilians?
There are a lot of issues where the Houthis block aid, or they siphon it off, or they charge extortionate amounts of money. So the Houthis are as much to blame for the humanitarian crisis as the coalition side and the Saudis. But there is one side of this war which has the capability to bomb cities and towns, and one that doesn't, and one causes greater damage than the other for obvious reasons.
And obviously you're suggesting there that the Saudi-led coalition have the resources, but a lot of people talk about this almost as a proxy war between Saudi and Iran. I mean, are the Houthis backed by Iran?
Technically, that's correct. That's the case. But when we talk about the Houthis being an Iranian proxy, that's quite overstated. They are not that sophisticated a movement. And there have been several cases in the war where the Houthis have ignored the things that Tehran has told them to do or not do.
Her name means hope in Arabic. But this morning, we have a sad update to share with you. A 7-year-old Yemeni girl who has become a striking symbol of the dire situation in her war-torn country. You see her there. She's died.
Okay, and now we're seeing pictures coming out of Yemen that are just totally shocking. A starving 7-year-old girl who has just died. How bad is the crisis?
Yemen is the worst humanitarian crisis in the whole world right now. And it's crazy that so few people know anything about it. Before the war, the population was 22 million people. At least half of that is now on the brink of starvation. The UN is basically about to declare a famine. The last official UN figure is that the war has killed 10,000 people, but that hasn't been updated in years, and it's likely that many, many, many more people than that have died. There's also the resurgence of diseases like cholera and polio. It's a complete mess on almost every front, and it could be alleviated very quickly if there was a policy shift from Western governments to sort of end support for the Saudi-led coalition side of things.
Is there any sign there that people understand who it is who are supplying the arms to Saudi Arabia?
A lot of Yemenis that I've spoken to are very aware that the Saudi planes that drop bombs on them, they know where those bombs come from. They know that they're manufactured in Britain and in the US. There's now a kind of cottage industry in certain cities where people collect scrap metal and debris from bomb fragments after bombing raids and can resell that or use that. If you find a bit of metal on the ground and it has a serial number on the side of it, it's very easy for someone in Yemen to put that into Google, into the internet, and, you know, trace it immediately back to a UK company or an American company. There's BAE Systems, there's Lockheed Martin, there's Boeing, there's Raytheon. Those are all companies that have British factories that are involved in this manufacturing.
And when you're there, I mean, you're a British reporter, how do people respond to you on the ground?
It's very difficult sometimes to speak to Yemenis on the ground about the causes of the war and the reasons why it is ongoing. If you're British, people know that that's where these armaments and these bombs are coming from. And people often ask, you know, can't you tell your governments, can't you tell your country to stop doing this? Why are you selling these arms when you can see the damage that they cause? Why does nobody care? And it's difficult to have an answer to that question a lot of the time.
Look, I think Summer, I totally understand.
I recently heard an interview with the Conservative MP, Johnny Mercer, which I thought was really odd.
The reality is, if we don't try and get in the decision-making process of the Saudis who are doing targeting in Yemen and give them and sell them munitions that are precision-targeted, okay, and they go back to then employing other people who don't have the rigour and standard that we do and using ammunition that does not, that you cannot target and things like that, the situation could get a whole lot worse.
I mean, he was arguing that it's not as easy as just cutting off arms sales, but he then made this point that in a way, it's better that Britain is selling the arms than other countries, because at least the weapons
are laser targeted, suggesting that in part that might limit the number of civilian casualties. What do you make of that?
I think that's completely ludicrous. I think if Johnny Mercer actually visited Yemen and saw the situation on the ground, he'd probably change his mind. You know, we say the UK government says that we only sell to countries who meet our ethical requirements and reporting standards. But I mean, that's completely disproven by the facts on the ground in Yemen.
Welcome, everyone. We begin with the ugly reality of the brutal war in Yemen. Innocent children climbed aboard a school bus like all children around the world, but these children were suddenly hit by a Saudi-led coalition airstrike.
In August, there was about 40, 50 little boys who were on a school trip, and they were hit by a coalition missile.
Did they all die?
51 people died, and I think more than 30 children died. There's no way that was a military target.
And is Britain's involvement just in selling arms to Saudi Arabia?
Our politicians like to peddle this kind of myth that we sell arms to Saudi Arabia and that is the beginning and the end of our involvement in Yemen's war. In reality, we are actually a lot more complicit than that. There's British personnel who are stationed in the bombing control rooms in Riyadh. There are technicians who look after the planes and refueling. There's at least two Scottish regiments on the ground who provide training for Saudi forces. I mean, this is also just the tip of the iceberg. This is information that it's been very difficult to get the government to admit to.
Everyone's actually talking about Saudi Arabia at the moment because of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi, and I know you've been covering that as well.
I am surprised and I am sad that it took the murder of one journalist to really reignite the debate about what our relationship with Saudi Arabia looks like and what it should or could look like. But I do understand that, you know, one man's story maybe resonates a lot more than hundreds of thousands of people who are dying in a country that's far away and that nobody really knows very much about.
We did hear from Jeremy Hunt, the Foreign Secretary, on the radio talking about Saudi Arabia.
But our relationship with Saudi is a strategic relationship as well. Our response will be considered because we have to recognise in that strategic relationship that they share intelligence with us that helps keep people safe on the streets of Britain.
But I was really struck when he reached the end of one interview and said, look, we can't forget our strategic relationship with Saudi. I mean, what do they mean when they say that?
If you're talking about its kind of role in relationship to Britain, I mean, it's still the world's biggest oil exporter. We make a lot of money out of arms deals. And the Trump administration has made Saudi Arabia completely central and key to its objectives in the Middle East. It wants Saudi Arabia to help it contain Iran and Iranian influence, basically. As part of the fallout from the Khashoggi affair, the US has actually said that they want a ceasefire in Yemen in the next 30 days and they want peace talks to restart. But I think that is words more than actions. Even though there is this debate right now about what we should do about Saudi Arabia going forward and whether we should support it, I mean, I don't really fundamentally see that relationship changing, and I think arms sales are going to continue.
So what does all of this mean for Yemen and Hodeidah, the port city we talked about at the start?
I mean, despite what the US has said in the last couple of days, on the ground there's been a lot of shelling. There's a lot of UAE and Saudi-backed Yemeni militias that are kind of amassing on the outskirts of the city. It does look like this offensive could begin at any day, and the people who live there have been struggling with this as their reality for months at this point. But it's definitely possible to avert this particular offensive and to save the port of Hodeidah. And the UN's been, you know, trying desperately to broker some kind of ceasefire there without much luck so far. But if there was pressure from Saudi Arabia's Western allies, that would be helpful in alleviating the situation a bit. And in the interim, if there's any damage to Hodeidah's ports and to those facilities, then that's going to have huge, huge consequences for the whole country. That means millions of people are going to starve.
Even if the war stops now, even if the Houthis and the Saudi-led coalition drop their weapons and reach a peace agreement, Yemen has been devastated by years of conflict. Ahmed, however, is still hopeful to return home to Hodeida and those days on the beach.
You can see in the video, I am with my family, with my children, with my brother in the beach. My son... Very happy. My son, he still remembers this day and the old holidays, weekends. And always he said to me, Baba, when we are going to the Hodeida, to the beach, I want to go to play on the beach again. I always tell him soon, inshallah, soon we will go there together.
After the break, in Opinion, we meet a man who has travelled the world collecting the sounds of wildlife. Welcome back. Bernie Krause is a sound ecologist and he's spent the past four decades recording natural soundscapes across the globe. He's collected an extraordinary archive that reveals a dramatic decline in biodiversity.
I don't have very good eyesight, so my world is very much informed by what I hear. When I turned on that tape recorder in a forest north of San Francisco in 1968, it transformed my life the minute I switched that on. Working in the wild with natural sound, it made me feel part of a living world that I'd never noticed before. I made the determination I was going to figure out a way to make that happen for the rest of my life. So I'm a soundscape ecologist now. The first thing that I noticed when I was recording these soundscapes, a habitat that's healthy sounds very organized, much like instruments in an orchestra. And when I recognized that, I realized that we could probably tell the health of a habitat from just listening to these soundscapes. Birds, mammals, reptiles, insects, they're all in relative balance with one another. In 2018 represents my 50th year in the field of recording these sounds, and over that time, I've recorded perhaps 1,200 different types of habitats like deserts and mountains, tropical rainforests, coral reefs, deep ocean. And overall, I've recorded like 5,000 hours of material from around the world. And I've identified over 15,000 creature voices. But in that time, over 50% of my archive comes from habitats that are either altogether silent or can no longer be heard in any of their original form. That, to me, is appalling. It's not species that we're losing. It's whole habitats, whole environments, places that we depend on for oxygen and for all kinds of other things that make our lives healthy. And that we're losing those is just incredible. And the rate at which we're losing them is even more astonishing to me. Not only have soundscapes diminished in richness, but also in density and diversity. Here's a really good example. When recording in a place near where I live in Northern California, a place called Sugarloaf State Park, I've actually recorded a direct result of global warming, an historic drought that our area has endured since 2011. This first example was recorded in 2004 when it was still viable. The next example was recorded in 2015, the fifth year of the drought when I captured the first silent spring I've ever experienced. There are two major reasons. The first is human endeavor, of course. That's resource extraction, both forests and mining, fracking, fishing out the oceans, and so on. The other reason is just global warming. Global warming is changing all of the equations. It's happening so fast. You know, every morning that I get up and I swing my old legs over the side of the bed, I try to think to myself, what do I do now and how do I make this a better place? And it used to be that I was fairly optimistic about what could be done. But now I've kind of lost that optimism. I still have a lot of hope, but I just don't feel the weight of good change being on our side at this point. But I never put this stuff out of my mind. I go into the field several times a month to try to get these recordings. I want people to hear the beauty of what it is they're losing and to have a chance to make up their minds that this is something really worth preserving.
This opinion piece is part of a new Guardian series called The Age of Extinction. It looks at the impact humanity is having on global wildlife populations and asks, how can we fight back? You can read more at theguardian.com. That's it for today. If you liked it, please subscribe and leave us a review. My thanks to Ahmed, Bethan McKernan and Bernie Krause. Today's producers are Brenna Duldorf, Elizabeth Cassin and David Waters. Sound design is by Axel Cacoutier. The executives are Nicole Jackson, India Rackerson, and Phil Maynard. See you tomorrow.